When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the One Hit Minute Productions Patreon podcast. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and we have been doing a decade project, and we'll continue to do a decade project. It's the year of our Lord 2023. We're diving back 10 years to look at the movies that still deeply resonate with myself and my incredible guests. And this was the most obvious selection that I could possibly have made between content, between subject, and guest of all time. This is a movie that in 2013 at the Sydney Film Festival, there was an audience rapturously anticipating a Drive sequel. And as I sat down and this film played, I've never seen more walkouts in any film that I've ever been a part of. And it was particularly noticeable in like a 2,500 seat theater that by the end had about 1,500 people left in it. And so it is my pleasure to welcome the host of Increment Vice, a friend and family member of all things One Hit Minute Productions, the legendary Travis Woods, to talk about Nicholas Winding Refn's Only God Forgives.
When I was pregnant with you, it was strange you were different. They wanted me to terminate, but I wouldn't. They don't understand you. And I never will.
Trav,
time to meet the devil.
Time to meet the devil. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. Always happy to talk about some neon shaded pretentiousness. As is any card carrying member of film Twitter, if it's got neon in it,
it must be good, right?
You got to talk about it. I actually think this is quite good. It shouldn't be good. It shouldn't be. For reasons we'll discuss.
Yes,
this should not work. And from a lot of people would argue it doesn't work. I want to say something real quick. Let's start off. Let's come right out of the gate here. Let's pull the pin on this. You and I are recording this while shaded beneath a cataract of grief.
Yes.
Because we lost one of the greats this week, the week that this has been recorded. We lost director Hurricane Billy Friedkin.
Billy.
He passed away.
May rest in peace.
This
God
week.
God bless him.
I saw someone wrote, I hope he died peacefully because that's the only peaceful thing he'd ever do. And I think the great Anna Swanson wrote that, but if she didn't, apologies to her, both her and whoever did say it. But the reason I want to talk about Friedkin as a means of entry into Only God Forgives is, and, a lot of people probably saw this past week, where they famously, Friedkin and Refn had a couple conversations about Sorcerer
Yes.
and Only God Forgives, and Refn desperately wanting to link Only God Forgives to Sorcerer. What I'm gonna do, for this very special episode is I'm gonna actually do a little story time. Start off with a little story time.
Can I just say, I've heard this
Blake knows where
story
this is
without
going. Yeah.
I've heard this story. And I'm so glad it's being committed to tape. I'm so glad
Yeah.
it's being committed to tape.
There's a lot of other parts of the story that we're going to save for maybe a later thing, but for today, I will mention this, which is a couple of, just a few years ago, I was on the phone with Billy Friedkin, and I'm going to call him Billy because he told me to, not because I'm one of these people that's like, oh yeah, I saw Marty Scorsese's King of Comedy with Bobby De Niro. It was great. Friedkin insisted that you call him Billy, so I'm going to, out of respect, call him Billy. I was on the phone with Billy Friedkin for about 2 hours. We were talking about this other
Oh my
thing,
God.
and after we got done talking about that other thing, which will come up sometime maybe in the future on one
Sometime in the future.
productions, but we were talking about a thing, and then when we got done talking about that thing, we started talking about other things, and mainly what we talked about, of course, were the movies. And this was early 2021, I think, and so there weren't a lot of new movies coming out, and so we were talking about the last 10 years of cinema in general. At one point, Friedkin just started barking out director names. A lot of sacred cows were slaughtered that day, and I'm not gonna talk about it here because I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But he's definitely a man of opinion, a man prone to volume. And but one of the names he shouted out, Nick Reffin, he's my friend, but my God, that kid doesn't have a fucking clue what his movies are about, with all this crap, all this neon pop music crap. He doesn't have a fucking clue what his movies are about. As I'm standing there trembling, shaking,
Oh,
just
God.
hoping not to say anything that pisses him. He told us, I'm setting a scene. I promise, as I always do, I promise this is going to go somewhere.
No.
But
I love this so. I love it, and I'm chuckling because I know you. Like Travis is a tough egg, but sometimes he like with the adoration that he has for the great Billy Friedkin, just the fact that he was so ruthlessly candid with you, it almost feels like a dream. And I'm imagining
yeah.
your face on that phone call, and it just gives me the giggles. Like I just your
Oh my
face,
God.
I'm like, oh my fucking
I
God.
was, I never truly understood the term flop sweat until that call. And my body was sheened with a second layer of skin that was purely liquid. As I was shedding my body weight through my pores, I was in a panic, but I was also entertained because that nickname, Hurricane Billy, he was pure Hurricane Billy. He was not in a good mood that day. He was very nice to me, but he was not in a good mood. And so anyway, he's like, Nick Reffin, he's my friend, but he doesn't have a fucking clue what his movies are about. He's like, I'm gonna tell you something. He's like, that little prick, he once said that he'd never seen Walter Hill's The Driver. Come on. And I'm like, okay, sure, Mr. Friedkin. Call me Billy. Okay, sure, Billy. I get it. He's like, now listen to this. I once surprised his ass. He's like, I once invited him over to my home. He's got a very the thing that it's hard to do. I can't do it well, but if you want to attempt a Friedkin impression, you basically have to do Christopher Walken, but with
It's
like a
close.
Chicago accent. Or accent, excuse me. But he's like, I invited that little prick to my home. And he comes over in his little shorts, like he's little Lord Fauntleroy. And I surprise him by having my good friend Walter Hill at the dinner table. And he goes on to say, he basically, famously, for those listening, if you're listening to an episode about Only God Forgives, you've probably seen Drive. And if you've seen Drive, you maybe have seen The Driver by Walter Hill, which you
Should
definitely
have.
should.
You
But
should
if you've
have.
seen Drive and The Driver, you do know that basically the opening 10 minutes of Nicholas Winding Refn's Drive is essentially the first 10 minutes of Walter Hill's The Driver, with not as great action in Drive. The Driver's better and has a better opening sequence, but it's him riffing on that. If we're going to use car lingo, he's using the chassis of the introduction of The Driver to be the introduction for Drive. And Friedkin was incensed that Refn had the temerity to do that and then claimed that he had never seen Walter Hill's movie. And so he got Refn to admit to Walter Hill that night over dinner that he had indeed fucking seen The Driver and that he had used that intro as a means to getting into the story of Drive. And I say that not just because it's a great story, not just because, like I said, we are all mourning the loss of one of the big faces of cinemas of New Hollywood's Mount Rushmore. But because we are talking about Nick Refn, and we're talking about Only God Forgives, which is a film that I don't think Refn understood while writing it. I don't think it's a story or a film that he understood while filming it. I don't think it's a movie that he understood while editing it. I think it's a film that he only understood once he had watched it.
Yes.
And we're going to get into that, but I say that I don't know, Blake, how much you know about how Only God Forgives came to be.
I
If you
would,
even.
I do know bits and pieces, but you're here, so why would I not want you to tell it? Because there's a
Okay, sure,
you have
sure.
a you are first and foremost a great storyteller. So I'm all ears, and so are the
All right,
people listening.
well. Story time, more story time, I guess. So, before he released this kind of candied, pop film vision that Drive became, dream pop vision,
Our friend S.A. Cosby and Jen Johans call it neon noir, like that for
Neon Noir. That's a good. Yeah, that's very clever.
nice,
It
very
is.
cute.
It is Neon Noir. That is what it is. It's neon noir. It is part of that genre. Before he made his Neon Noir breakthrough into popular cinema with Drive, and forever helped us ID the douchebags at the bar and the club by giving them a jacket they could wear that is basically Red Flag incarnate.
The only person that can wear that jacket, unironically, is Roxana Haddadi. And if
Oh yeah,
Roxana is
okay,
wearing that
sure.
jacket, that's as cool as
She
shit
gets
to
a
me.
pass.
She gets a
And
pass.
plus, no one loves Baby Goose. No one loves Baby Goose more than her, I don't think. So,
No.
she can do what she wants. But before the making of Drive, Refn was set to make Only God Forgives as his next movie, and he was securing financing with the film company Wild Bunch. And what's funny is, I'm taking Refn at his word here, which is kind of hard to do. He is a bit like Friedkin in that he is a provocateur and a raconteur. And so you're never entirely 1,000% sure how real the story is he's telling you, how much is done with a wink and how much is done with total sincerity, much like his films, Refn. But he was talking to the folks at Wild Bunch, and he basically he did not have a movie. But he wanted to secure financing for him. He didn't have an idea for a movie really, beyond they're like he you know we've made movies before, let's get a deal done. And they're like, well, what's your movie about? And he's like, it's about Muay Thai boxing and fighting in Bangkok. He just spit that out as like a fuck, hopefully they'll go for it. And it's about two fighters in Bangkok going up against each other via Muay Thai. And they're like, sure, okay, we'll pay for three quarters, you pay for one quarter, there you go, good deal. Now what happened then is that Ryan Gosling was also talking to him about Drive, and he wanted to make Drive right away. So they put Only God Forgives on the back burner, which was already at that point it was a thin, barely sketched sentence of a premise.
Yes.
There were no Oedipus complexes. There was no Shakespearean or biblical stuff. It was just two guys beating the shit out of each other in Bangkok. And so they go, they make Drive.
And next he's gonna say he's
Drive.
never seen Kickboxer, you know?
Oh boy, who cares? Come on, God. Everyone's seen that. Or Bloodsport, or
Or
Bloodsport.
Hot Shots Part Two, where Charlie
Oh
Sheen does
God,
it, an amazing rip off of
brief nod to Hot Shots Part Deux. Maybe the thing
Travis,
that makes me laugh hardest.
I now have a Hot Shots, an original theatrical Hot Shots 2 poster adorning my roof in my office.
Oh, I like your style, Blake. I always laugh when he dips his hands in caramel and he lifts them up with the gummy bears attached, and he screams in victory. I still think that's maybe the funniest 3 seconds in cinema. He goes and he makes Drive, a film that is both wildly successful and wildly misunderstood because it's essentially Taxi Driver. Set to dream pop, spoiler, the driver is not the hero of that movie. The driver is a motherfucking maniac. If that movie was made in 1978, it'd be starring sweaty, bloated Joe Spinell as the fucking driver. All right, I mean, he basically did make his version of Driver. It's called Maniac. And that's that is essential. It's a great double feature, actually. But put a pin in that, Blake. So anyway, that movie gets released, wildly successful, and now it's time. Now it's time for Only God Forgives. And I think the reason I mentioned that Friedkin story is, as I was recently rewatching the film for this podcast, I found that there was a lot to work with story-wise in this film, thematically in this film. But I think it was almost all out of a kind of desperation. And if you watch the film My Life, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, which was a documentary about the making of this film, directed by Refn's wife, whose name I know I'm not going to get right, but it's Liz Corfixen, I think. And it's essentially, it's not quite Hearts of Darkness, in terms of its thrills. It's not exactly the making of Apocalypse Now, but it is a portrait of an artist who has no clue what the fuck to do next after Drive and the expectations of Drive. And it's very much an artist wanting to go back to making the weirdo European perverse movies that he made before Drive, that Drive sort of secretly is. And
Drive has all the weird stuff in there, but it's just couched in such a consumable genre
yeah, well, I mean,
that it's easy to sort of palate. But when you go back and look at if you look at Drive in its component parts, I think you're so right that all of that dark, awful shit is there. Like watching Gosling like hammer a guy to death in front of a bunch of semi-naked women is not a fun heroic scene by any stretch of the imagination. And yet, for whatever reason, in the course and sequencing of the events that you remember it in your head, you're like, yeah, he beats that guy up for, threatening this mum and her little boy. And you're like, but also
Well,
he's a psycho.
we've been trained. We've been trained to watch movies like that. It's a movie that stars a Hollywood pretty boy driving a badass car, doing badass crime shit, talking to a pretty girl. And there's worse people that he's dealing with, people that are worse than him. And he solves his problems with those people violently. And so everything about the movies that we've seen and we've loved. And I'll say this out of judgment, but there's a certain kind of cinematic vocabulary that we learn really early on, and the film tricks us by speaking with that accent, but not using the exact same words, by whispering something actually quite weird and devious to us, but accented in such a friendly way that we are like, oh yeah, he's the hero. He's a real hero, a real human being.
Oh yeah, he's a
When
real human being. I wonder why I'm thinking that.
he's like one step away from being Tommy Wiseau in The Room, the driver. Like, he is a seriously damaged human being, who, is just a force of absolute chaos, who really can't seem to ever read a room that he's in, and instead just kind of trembles and looks like a lost baby with his face splattered in blood every time he does a boom boom. and murders somebody. But anyway, we digress. This gets us to Only God Forgives, which is a film that I think had a very bare bones plot going into it. And I think, and if you watch this, My Life, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn.
If you and I love what you said there also, just as a modus operandi, like I think that someone like if you watch Hearts of Darkness by Francis Ford Coppola's wife and you watch that movie, Francis in the middle of that is so emotionally naked that it becomes so revelatory because it's like you're getting an insight. The difference with My Life, I think you nailed perfectly, is Refn has such a performative aspect to his own storytelling that you don't ever quite know whether you're getting those depths or he's performing them. Makes it a very curious artifact because you're like, when I was watching it too, it's very hard to take it immediate face value if you know anything about Refn. Like you're just kind of like, he's kind of always a bit playful, always a bit of a shitbag, always a bit like high on his own supply sort of deal.
And that said, I do think there's a moment of realness in the film. There's maybe two actually, where I think, okay, I think he's being real. He's dropping the fuck around shit and he's being real with this. And there's one where he literally slaps himself in the face and snaps at his wife because she's like, "What are you so bummed about this? What is your problem with this movie?" And he slaps him because I fucking made a terrible movie. That's why. Like I it's terrible. Like he after the film is wrapped and they're editing and they're in post, and he literally like he slaps himself in the face. And you almost think for a minute he's gonna like lunge at her. I don't think that he does not cut an intimidating figure, Refn, but in that moment, he becomes like a Refn character and he becomes very threatening and odd and dangerous feeling as he slaps himself and he snaps, I've made a bad film. That's why I'm mad. Stop asking me why I'm mad. I'm at a bad fucking movie. And then a little bit earlier in the film, he's very depressed and despondent, sitting on a couch. And she's again, she's like, "What is your problem? What is wrong with you? You got this. Get Ryan Gosling in another movie, blah, 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 blah. It's a great script." And he's like, "I have no fucking idea what my movie's about. I have no idea what this movie's about." All of which is to say that I think that in a panic, kind of maybe like what he did with Drive, where he's like, "I'm going to grab a pre-existing work called The Driver to be my fulcrum, to leverage my aesthetics and my thematic preoccupations and my visual style into a movie." I think that with this film, he very wisely and cannily turned to where storytelling really begins. He went to Shakespeare, he went to the Greeks, and he went to the Bible. And he basically strip mined these things for the themes that were most aligned with his visual storytelling. And I think he's like, "What if I took a little bit of the Oedipus tragedy? What if I took a little bit of the Old Testament, especially the idea of a vengeful God and the idea of hands as the physical manifestation of our ability to craft our own destinies, because we were both blessed and cursed with free will. And what if I just took a dash of Lady Macbeth here and there with a little, what if Lady Macbeth was Hamlet's mom? What would that look like?"
And
And
what if I
so
cast a phenomenally appropriately hot and devious Kristen Scott Thomas to play that? That's
who basically plays a mix of Donatella Versace and Gemma Teller from Sons of Anarchy, who herself is a Xerox copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of Lady Macbeth. And yeah, I always think of Katie Sagal because they look quite a lot alike in this film as well. It's odd. You expect Charlie Hunnam just to come in out of nowhere swaggering with a pair of white kicks and his leather cut on. But I digress again. And so I think that if you have those things in mind, and it's hard not to have those things in mind when you watch this movie, although I think quite a few people just turned their minds off when they watched this because they were so infuriated by its very kind of glacial pace, the fact that the lead actor only has 17 lines of dialogue. But this is a film, I think, that more than anything else See, we're 2 hours later, we're getting to it. I think this is a film that more than anything else is about humanity's relationship to its God, whatever God you might happen to have, if you have one. I don't have the knack for faith, but those who do have a relationship with the God of their choosing. And this film is very much, I think, about that. So, at its atomic core, this is an Old Testament story about man's relationship to God. And Refn himself, after the film was made, he had a daughter, and then his wife had a second daughter, who pops up in the documentary a couple times, and as a toddler. And Refn found himself in a panic after the birth of his second daughter. He found himself full of rage and anxiety at the world that he had delivered his daughter into. And so he didn't know what to do with those feelings. And he had himself, there was a moment where he said he was fantasizing about fighting God as an outlet for those feelings. What if I just could just if I could just beat the shit out of God for setting these rules up in opposition to me. And I think that you can really look at this film as a story of Julian, played by Baby Goose himself, Ryan Gosling, as this American expat. He lives in Bangkok. He runs a Muay Thai fighting club with his brother Billy. And Julian is a man who is, much like the driver, he's very damaged. He's always contemplating his hands. And we learn throughout the film that he's basically Oedipus, in that he killed his father, beat him to death, killed his father, beat him to death with his own bare hands. It's hinted through Kristen Scott, Chris, excuse me, Kristen Scott Thomas's performance. It's hinted, it's not made explicit, although it was made explicit in the script, that brothers Billy and Julian both had a sexual relationship with their mom, and that Julian beat their father to death over it because their dad was not happy about this. And so he's constantly considering his hands in this film, and much like a human being in the Old Testament, the human soul in the Old Testament, of the Bible, he is considering what his hands can do, that they are capable of phenomenal acts of evil and violence, but they are also capable of unclenching, opening up, and seeking love and solace and pleasure from another. And I think that that is the central preoccupation of this kind of non-entity of a character, is he, what is the Old Testament? What is the Bible but an ongoing story of good and evil, an eternal Muay Thai fight between the forces of good and the forces of evil, and
A bare knuckle Muay Thai
a
fight
bare
at
knuckle
that.
Muay Thai fight? And so all of a sudden, that offhand Muay Thai reference actually plays well in the film, because it's a film about the bare knuckle brawl, not just between good and evil, but the eternal dilemma of free will, which is what color shorts, which fighter shorts are you putting on? Are you the hero or the heavy? And throughout the film, it gets mocked for this, but throughout the film, he's always staring at his hands, Gosling, and it's like he'll open them, he'll flex, and then he'll clench them. He'll open them, he'll clench them. And throughout the film, he's either using them to beat someone half to death, or no other way to say it, there's a woman that he could potentially have as a love interest, who at one point he opens his hands. Opens one hand, slides it between her legs, up her dress, and starts pleasuring her. And first you're watching that, and I'm like, okay, it's just a weird Refn sexual moment. But I think it's something different. I think it's meant to be something different. This is a man who is reaching for the womb, which is as close to
Yeah.
the powers of God that probably exist on Earth, aside from splitting the atom, which I don't think Julian is going to be doing anytime soon. But he's constantly reaching for the womb, where life can be created, because I think he is a character who is seeking rebirth. He is an Oedipus who has already enacted the tragedy of Oedipus.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And the film almost is a movie that asks, well, what happens after that?
Yeah,
And
and the film answers
well, you
punishment.
punishment. You end up living in Bangkok. Your evil brother murders a teenage prostitute, is murdered by the prostitute's father, and then that father has his hand lopped off by Chang, the local police lieutenant. And before, and just want to say one before we get to Chang, that I think that is the central preoccupation of Julian, of his character, is that he is a soul that is stuck between choosing good or evil, and evil is chosen via violence, via beating people to death with his bare hands, and good, it's pretty, yeah, this is very elemental stuff, is always reaching for the womb, reaching for the place where life is created. As a hopeful, as a means of rebirth for himself. And things get complicated by local police lieutenant Chang, this man who essentially is God. He's a
Yeah,
God. He's he's an Old Testament God.
he is. He's Vithya Pansringam. Pansringam plays
We're
Chang,
gonna fuck
and
these names up. We should
I'm gonna
probably
fuck.
put a
I'm so, just yeah.
disclaimer from
Put
the
just
get-go.
disclaimer to pronouncing Thai names. I'm gonna sort of fuck some of these up, but my God, is he an unfathomably unforgettable screen presence as Chang? Holy
Incredible.
hell!
He's absolutely.
I don't think I've ever seen an actor like that that made me tremble in my seat. He's genuinely terrifying.
I mean, you look at him at first and you're like, well, who's this little guy? Which is, what I think a lot of the characters also think in this film, which is, and none of them, and I think any of the characters that think that about him, they meet pretty poor ends. But he plays this somewhat rogue police lieutenant who enacts his own version of justice, vengeance, and forgiveness throughout Bangkok. And when he, for instance, when he discovers that Billy, Julian's wayward older brother, who has an enormous cock, according to his own mother, but
According to
Billy,
his own mother.
hey, she's the one that says it. Although she does say that Julian had a decent cock too, just nothing
Billy's.
like Billy's. This is an actual moment from the film.
Oh,
Let's just say, fellas, if you've ever been nervous about bringing a girl home to meet the folks, you've never had to live through a scene quite like this. I digress a third time.
don't count. Don't count the digressions
Okay.
because
That's gonna be. We should have like a
it's
little ringing bell, a little
Bing.
ringing bell each time. A little like at the like the one a bell you'd hear at the beginning of a Muay Thai round. Billy kills a teenage prostitute because he is also very much a venal Old Testament type of character. He just wants to revel and experience the worst of humanity. One of his very first lines of dialogue is he goes to a brothel, and he says this like it's something he's never done before. And he's just kind of offhandedly curious, the way that you or I might stroll into a convenience store and decide to try the new flavor of Skittles that is on the shelf. Billy just kind of stumbles on in and goes, I want to fuck a 14-year-old girl. He just says it like that, like I've, it's just something that's occurred to him, and it's a level of venality and carnality that he has yet to try, and why the fuck not? Well, I mean, I know why not. You know why not? Billy does not know why not.
For Billy, he doesn't. He
No, but
doesn't. He doesn't have that. He doesn't have that.
it's a line to cross. It's a thrill to experience, and he wants to experience something evil and depraved like that. And of course, so he ends up murdering that poor girl and Chang in what we think is going to be like every cop scene at the beginning of a cop movie ever, where it's that basic instinct scene where everyone shows up at Johnny Boz's house and or in Jade, it's a fuck house. Instead, Chang looks at the
I love how
situation and
quickly you can recall all the character names and just bomb a quote out of Basic Instinct. I love you
well,
so much.
that was from Jade, by the way. That was from the masterpiece. This Billy Friedkin's Jade, bring it back to Friedkin. It's a fuck house. Basically, Chang locks the dead girl's father in a room with Wayward Billy and lets the father beat him to death. And then Chang cuts off the father's right hand for allowing his daughter to be put in a situation like that. So he's this man
Vengeful
who
God.
is he's dealing out vengeance. And at first we're like, okay, this is just a rogue cop. But then there's this series of scenes in which every time Chang makes a decision like this, there's three major moments where he will do something like this, where he will enact a near biblical amount of bloodletting in the name of his own curious brand of justice. There will then be a hard cut to a karaoke bar where he is just singing. But he's not just who is he singing to? He's singing to every other cop that works for him. He's singing to his disciples. He's singing to the men who believe in him and who follow. He is singing gospels. Our good buddy Jed Ayers, I think, pointed that out, that these are his disciples. He's singing them their gospel. And in that way, you realize, oh, this is God. The movie is setting up this man as God. And if anyone have a passing familiarity with Western culture for the last 2,000 years, if there's a God, there's got to be a devil. And we get that in the form of Crystal Thompson, Scott Thomas, as the mother of Billy and Julian, who goes up in Bangkok to kill God for his role in the death of her son. And that sets up everything that is Only God Forgives, which is it then pushes Julian to this man who is eternally at war with himself between violence and between ending life and creating life, between touching the womb or beating a man until he's nothing but bone and pulp. And as I said, these are not exactly fresh themes. These are not exactly new ideas. But I think what happens here is I think that Refn recognized, hey, these themes work for a reason. These themes have been fucking, these things were cave paintings before we even had language, because they speak to us on some level.
They're elemental, man. They're
They
elemental
are
themes.
there, and they're it's like the three-act structure. I don't know why it works, but it's what works. It's what our brains respond to.
Yes.
And I think that he, much like the opening 10 minutes of Drive, he's like, well, what the fuck? What if I just take a little bit of the Oedipus tragedy? Can I do something a little new with it, which is what happens after Oedipus? What if I sprinkle in some
And what if
Hamlet
I
and some
sprinkle in that
Lady Macbeth?
there's no morality? Because that's the other thing about the Oedipus complex is like the characters who are undertaking that, the original characters who are now archetypes, know that they're doing something wrong and against God. And so it's almost like the punishment comes through. But what's so fascinating and perverse and very typically Refn is that in this, it's like, no, that like despite that they might have been displaced, but they don't regret their behaviors, and nor does it seem like the fucking has stopped, even though it's not explicit. in the movie. Well, it is extremely implicit in the movie. I don't know if you could say extremely implicit, but it's on that borderline where it's flat out inferred that it's still happening.
Well, honey bunny, I don't like to get into arguments with you, but I am going to get into a tiny one here where I'm going to make a slight disagreement.
You're allowed.
I think there is one moral choice made. Well,
oh, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
There are two moral choices made by at least a human being. I don't know if Chang, we can even call him a human being. If he's God and he appears to be, he's inventing morality. He's creating what morality is in this film.
Yeah.
By you allow your daughter to get killed by being a fucking 16-year-old sex worker. Well, I'm going to cut your goddamn hand off. Mm-hmm. And again, hands are so elementally part of this story. And if you notice, the hands pop up a lot in the Bible as well. You know, I mean, that's how you work. It's how you interact with the world. He's creating his own morality, whether or not it's right or wrong. It's an interesting question. You know, that's a whole other movie. Is what if God's wrong and we're still living in God's universe? Throughout the film, Julian is constantly pinballing between Chang and Crystal, and Crystal is begging him to kill Chang because Chang's got her number. Yeah. Chang knows that she's the force behind all of this. You know, she puts a hit on Chang at one point, and Chang does indeed want to kill her, and Chang doesn't really care about Julian. Chang just wants Julian out of the way. He even looks at him once, and imagine God says this about you. He says, "He's not the one." Like, he realizes that Julian's not a threat. So imagine God looks at you once and says, "He's not the one." Which is interesting. A lot of people said this movie was overly macho, and I think that's so funny because it's actually negatively macho. It's not macho at all. It's a film. I know I have De Palma on the brain because I'm writing a book about the man right now, but the way that all of De Palma's male characters for the most part are so kind of passive and impotent, both literally and figuratively. Julian is a man of impotence. He's a man who is so locked by Hamlet level indecision. He doesn't know what the fuck to do. Yes. And so at one point, Pang looks at him and goes, "He ain't the one. It's not him. We don't got to worry about this guy. He's not part of this." He basically taught, you know, he's Julian wants to be Michael Corleone, but he's really Fredo. There is a point in the film where Crystal promises Julian, "I'll be your mother again. I know I've already asked you to do this once with your father. I'm asking you to do it one more time. Can you take care of Chang?" He considers it, and we're going to get into some spoilery territory here. What the fuck? It's 10 years old. He goes to kill with a buddy of his. He goes to kill Chang and Chang's daughter. And he can't do it. He doesn't want the vengeance. There's no reason for it to spiral to Chang's daughter. And he doesn't like that. That's where he draws the line. He's willing to murder Chang, but he's not willing to murder Chang's daughter and let this cycle of vengeance continue on into eternity. And so instead he kills his friend that's about ready to kill Chang's daughter. He makes a moral choice to commit something evil, to do something evil in sake of a greater good. He starts muddying the water of the choice that God has given him. It's not so easy to just be purely good or be purely evil. He discovers that by doing something evil, he can do something good. And this is where the film kind of takes some of the black and white of biblical stories and taints it neon red and adds color and hue to it. Interestingly enough, every single time, the two times I think that where Chang and Crystal share screen time in the film, at the boxing ring and in her apartment, all of the neon red color drains from the film and everything is black and white.
Yeah, it is.
But when we see Julian, everything is stained red and is indistinct and hard to, the lines blur. And then the second moral choice comes from, we have this moment. Chang kills Crystal and Julian finds her body and he's carrying one of Chang's blades that he stole from Chang's house. And You can't even give Refn credit for this. During the making of the movie, Refn asked Gosling, "What would you do here? Would you laugh, or would your character laugh or cry at the discovery of his mom?" And Gosling said, "I'd cut open her womb to see what was inside." And that's what they filmed. And finally, we realize that even though he has chosen evil to do a good thing, he then, with his hands, these hands he's always considering to enact violence, once again opens his hand the way he does to slide it between that young woman's legs earlier in the film to touch her womb. He reaches deep inside his mother's own stomach and grasps the womb in which he was created. And there is a hard cut, and all of a sudden he's in the woods with Chang voluntarily. And it's as if he has enacted his own rebirth, the thing that he's wanted, to be recycled out of this life that he's created for himself, this Oedipus tragedy, this Oedipal tragedy he's created for himself. And in this moment of rebirth, what is the thing that he voluntarily does to go
Gives his
forward? He
hands, puts his hands straight up.
takes his fists and he puts them outward in front of Chang's blade. And he does so voluntarily. He's the only character that voluntarily offers themselves up. And it's a curious ending. And I think there's multiple ways of reading it, but it's almost, you could argue that he's saying, I want to enter this next, now that I am reborn and am going to live a different life, I want to remove the instruments of violence from myself, the instruments of hatred from myself. But he's removing the thing that lets him seek out rebirth and love if he were just to open his hands. And so it's a curious ending, and I don't know where you land. I have not landed on either one yet. I'm curious what you might think. I can't decide if he's choosing to live a life simply without violence going forward, or if he's literally saying, fuck this free will shit. Take away these things that are constantly making me choose one or the other, because I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to think about it. And so does it end almost like the truncated American version of the novel Clockwork Orange, where Alex just has his choice taken away from him. And does he choose just to not mature into a place where he can choose to just be good, even though he has the capability of evil? Or does he need that choice made for him? And I can't quite decide what the
Yeah,
movie is doing with that.
I think that's a really great question. I think it's the way that I would say that I've read it is I've landed sort of probably somewhere between the two that, but not in a fixed position. Because the thing that I see is that, like Chang's blades, his hands are the instruments of all of the chaos that has been in his life. And whether that's the touch, the inference of the touch with his mother and the whole Oedipal thing that's happening and all of the things and then the beating and the violence. And it's like, if you just take these and it's that thing is like, his idle hands were the devil's plaything and they were Crystal's devil's plaything, So at the time it's like, if I just give my hands up to God and I get him to sever them, then I can't use these instruments. I can't be a tool for evil. And so that's how I've kind of found that moment. And I don't know exactly where I land on it every single time I watch it because it's sort of like, I think you've perfectly synthesized like all of the things that really work for the movie about it, but it's like that final like sacrifice of getting rid of his hands. And but I've always I'm never actually sure, like, is he going to survive? Like, is he
I mean, that's
actually
another
going to survive?
question. I mean, there's a
That's
couple of
like,
them, a couple of important arteries in that area.
You sever both hands and he's in the woods. Like, I don't know. And he's in Thailand. So I don't know how close he is to the best medical facilities in Thailand. He's severing it off. And it's almost like, is that a kind of like, if I sever these hands, can I die in peace that the instruments of evil are gone and I can sort of maybe take this new transition state out of this thing and be ready to be forgiven? And therefore like have pass into the next life or pass into the next realm or however it's sort of phrased is, Yeah, I'm not sure he ever survives out of that. And honestly, I could watch it one time, my most recent time watching it in preparation for talking to you, or I could watch it, you know, 6 months ago, and I would probably have two different opinions.
Yeah, I don't know.
I always tend to think, and this is a weird digression. Ding, here we go again. But like, I went to Africa on my honeymoon with my wife, and when we were there, I grazed my knee playing football, or soccer, as Americans call it, with some of the locals. Like, we were just playing on a beach and I grazed my knee. Now, I've grazed my knee 1,000 times in my life. Like, fine. And in Australia, like, a grazed knee, you know, even if you're like swimming and having fun in the ocean or whatever, it's like the grazed knee goes away in like a week. You know, it scabs up, goes away. But in Africa, it didn't. I got a staph infection in that cut, and I had to take antibiotics in Africa, you know. And I remember that one of our guides who we were with, one of our tour guides that we were with, was like, yeah, like, is like Africa tries to kill you. Like, you don't heal, your body doesn't heal, and then it starts to get bad, and then you get sick, and then, you know, the circle of life is that animals smell your rotting wound and go, oh, there's someone weak here, I'm going to come and eat you. And so fortunately, we were on a trip with that one of our friends that we made on the trip was actually a nurse in her home life from New Zealand. And she helped me clean it, get it ready and bandage it up so that it would actually start healing. I took antibiotics and then it went away. But so the way that I think about it now is like, well, if I was in a Thai jungle, I think I'm dead. If he severs my hands, I'm going to bleed out.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's just my experience, because a graze nearly got me a staph infection that could have been life threatening in Africa.
I don't know. I bet Chang keeps a clean blade though. That's the great thing about this movie that I think it's so underrated, is it does pose those questions, which is, you know, what happens after post Oedipus? What happens? I know we know what happens after the Old Testament. There's a new one. You know, I do
the
think
sequel's
it's...
much brighter. The reboot was much brighter.
Yeah, only God forgives too. Neon Boogaloo. But it's a troubling everything about this movie is troubling, but it's a troubling way to end your movie, because for Refn, in that it's all, you know, the more I watch it, the more I think about it, it's almost like humanity in the form of Julian going back to God with a receipt. And just being like, this free will thing, you just can I return this? Can I cash this out and just go on my day without having to worry about this shit? And so, you know, you can view that ending as Julian saying, look, I nearly killed your daughter. I owe you my hands. I saved her, so you're not going to kill me, but I owe you my hands for being a part of this cycle of violence. You know, he does kill a cop that is guarding Chang's daughter, so it's you know, you could just view it, oh no, it's just the end of the cycle of vengeance ends with, you know, the very first shot of this movie is Julian considering these hands, and these hands that are, once you know after he clinches them, it cuts to, you know, Chang walking around a corner. It's almost as if the potential for violence, and when Julian clinches his hands, manifests God into this universe and gets his attention. And so it's fitting that the film would then end with him saying, here, take the fists away. But again, I wonder what the ultimate meaning of that is. Is it simply just, hey, you know, I fucked up, you got to take them. I get it. It's like you get in too many car accidents or too many speeding tickets, you lose that driver's license. Or is it something deeper, which is him saying, you know, these hands that are both capable of great violence, but also love and exploration and rebirth. Fuck it. I don't want to deal with choice anymore. Make me an automaton who can't choose. Because at least I won't be stressed out. At least I won't have to debate within myself which side of the Muay Thai fight between good and evil I want to be on. That's pretty troubling. And I don't know the answer, but you know who else doesn't know the answer, according to our good pal, Billy Friedkin? Nick Refn.
Nick Refn
doesn't have a fucking clue what his movies are about. I mean, he's my friend, but he doesn't have a fucking idea what Only God Forgives is. Oh, bless you, Billy. But yeah, that's, I think that in a moment of creative crisis, I think that Refn realized that, hey, go to the classics, slap some of my weird neon crime shit on there, and you got a movie, baby. Alienated all of the people it needed to alienate, which were the people who just want to drive to. And it's not quite
Deeply alienate all the people
deeply
you want to
alienated. It's not
deeply
quite
alienate.
sorcerer the way I think Refn wants people to think that only God forgives a sorcerer. Refn always seems to forget. Friedkin didn't want to alienate anybody with sorcerer. He thought he was making his ultimate box office smash masterpiece with sorcerer. It didn't work out that way. But Friedkin, or excuse me, Refn, I think the only thing Refn knew when he was making this movie is that he wanted to alienate the bros. And alienate.
And he's continued to do that. Neon Demon, Too Old to Die Young, and even Copenhagen Cowboy. He's continued to alienate the bros. He loves
Which,
alienating bros.
to his credit, I think he knew what those projects were when he started them.
Yes.
With this one, I think he had a movie where he's like, fuck, I gotta make a movie about Muay Thai boxing. What the fuck? How do I don't know anything. He talks in the commentary track when he's like, I don't know anything about this shit. I just blurted it out to the executives, and they gave me money. But I think he was like, you can pick and choose some of the best themes from the best, most elemental human stories, and use that as a showcase for his visual sensibilities, which are absolutely stunning. And hey, you got a movie. You got a movie, baby. You got a stew going. He's like, he's like Carl Weathers in Arrested Development. Get a broth, a couple chicken bones, you got a stew, baby. And I think that's what happened with Only God Forgives, which I think is a masterpiece. I think it is exquisite and classy.
He doesn't know a fucking
No,
movies.
but Reppin doesn't know what the fuck it is. And if he tells you it's a masterpiece, don't listen, because he didn't know. He wouldn't even know why it's a masterpiece. You and I do. We know why.
We know.
But I think it is a masterpiece. I think it is him operating at the height of his very strange, sometimes dubious skill set. And it is certainly not, absolutely not for everyone, especially because it is a film that tells so much of its story visually. And very strangely, a lot of audiences, despite film being a visual medium, do not like when films just tell their story visually, and they don't have someone connecting the dots. Even though, hey, Chris Scott Thomas rolls in and I think lays it out pretty graphically in one uncomfortable dinner sequence. But people might be distracted by Willie's enormous cock in that scene. Who knows? But I think it is a I think it is a masterpiece. I think it is transcendent in that it transcends his simple neon noir roots and goes again for something more elemental. It's not Shakespeare. It's not Greek tragedy. But it uses those things to a very interesting degree to ask some very actually fascinating questions that I don't think the film answers. I think the film wants us to figure out. I think I'm not going to give Reverend total credit for that. I think he wants us to figure it out because he fucking can't. But it wants us to figure out.
He's not quite like Abbas Kiarostami, like the Iranian filmmaker is like movies are alive when you have to lean in and I'm going to make you do part of the work, because for me, designing a movie that has a lot of gaps that I need you to pour yourself into to interrogate as the film is unfolding is important to me. That doesn't seem to be, he doesn't seem to be as delicate in his cinematic poetic
No,
storytelling as
but
someone like
hey,
that.
you know what? If nothing else, it is a gorgeously shot, gorgeously framed. I hate when people compare something to Kubrick because it's just such a lazy, junk drawer shorthand film bro thing to say. But this definitely does have that Kubrickian sense of style and pacing, and every single frame is a portrait. You can just hit pause and stare at, or you don't even have to hit pause because most of the shots are so fucking long and unmoving. You can really immerse yourselves, but it's a living, breathing neon Rorschach. And you someone else who might like the movie might watch it and be like, Oedipus, the Bible, and Shakespeare, what the fuck are you talking about? It's a kickboxing movie. Or they might just be, no, it's just it's a crime movie where not a lot of dialogue occurs. It's just a basic ass crime movie. It's Black Rain with less dialogue, babe.
Come on, babe.
But
can't have less dialogue than Black Rain, babe.
Well, but I do think it is a masterpiece of sorts. And I think it's probably in my Neon Demon gives it a good run. I think that probably it is his best movie. Even if he didn't intend, even if it's not his best movie in the way he intended, I think just simply because he attaches this film to themes that are so elemental and immortal and of ever-present and eternal concern to any thinking human being, it's hard for me to see this movie and not feel that debate. What am I going to do with these hands? And I think that's kind of the eternal debate. And I think he made a movie about that, even though he didn't realize it until he was watching at the premiere of the Cannes Film Festival a year later. But yeah, that's Only God Forgives to me.
Well, that is the perfect outro because I'm gonna leave you wondering with Travis's hints, and ruminating on the big thoughts that can be in a movie in the only the way that Travis can do, and say, you know what? He's damn good when you get him behind a microphone. What is he gonna do with these hands? What is he gonna do with these hands? Is he gonna clench those fists and come back and fight for something else? Who knows? But Travis Woods, it is always my greatest pleasure to talk to you on shows like this because no one bleeds like you bleed for movies, as our friend Jordan Harper said. So, man, thank you so much for coming to talk to me about this movie. We'll have to think of another movie in 2014 as the Decade Project continues. You're gonna have to go to your 2014 list and see if anything pops off there. I
Well, there's
know.
a movie called Inherent Vice came out in December of 2014. Maybe I ought to talk about that.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you remember this, but we kind of did about,
Oh,
I don't know,
that's right.
what's an hour and a half times 46, kind of, maybe 67 hours of show,
Man,
maybe more on that,
we did a
way
lot.
more
We
than
did a lot.
there was a lot on that. So we maybe don't have to go back to that one, but there could be others that are in 2014 that might be of interest. But man, thank you so much for doing this. This is going to go up on our Patreon as well first before people hear it, before our American Cinematheque Inherent Vice or any. So you want to say just a couple of words about that?
Well, hell, any LA listeners or hey, listeners anywhere else, but they got a little extra cash to spend. You want to fly on out? Like, we got a couple of people who are doing that. The American Cinematheque, which is an organization out here in beautiful sunny Los Angeles, that organizes screenings at the Los Feliz 3, the Arrow Theater, the currently under construction Egyptian Theater. The American Cinematheque is. It's just a, it's a place, it's an organization that loves film, believes in film. They put on the best screenings. They're big supporters of things like Beyond Fest, which is the greatest film festival ever that we have every year in Los Angeles, the genre film festival. But anyway, the American Cinematheque is putting on a film festival called Friends of the Fest, in which they are corralling, a bunch of hotshot film podcasts and the hosts of these podcasts to present films. And you've got one handsome Blake Howard making history by being the only person to have not one, but two podcasts being celebrated in that Miami Nice will be kicking off this film festival with a screening of Miami Vice at the Los Feliz 3 on August 24th, 7 p.m. And then that Saturday night, August 26th, also at 7 p.m. at the Los Feliz 3, I will be hosting with Blake projected blazingly huge on the screen behind me, like Marlon Brando's giant head behind Christopher Reeve in Superman. We will be presenting a 35 millimeter, glorious 35 millimeter screening of Inherent Vice, a film that, yes, we did 46 episodes of a podcast on with hotshots like Paul Thomas Anderson, Kim Morgan, and Rian Johnson, buddies like S.A. Cosby and Jordan Harper. And yeah, we're gonna do one last victory lap for Increment Vice, our little podcast that could and talk about the film Inherent Vice. Tickets are still available. Miami Vice has already sold out because it's Miami fucking Vice. But you Increment and Inherent Vice heads out there, if you're looking for a good time. And by the way, if you're looking for some free weed, I will be bringing some, as well as
it's free legal in California, frozen, ladies and gentlemen. Legals in California.
Legal in California. Show me your ID. Let's make it just show me that you're over 21. I'm also going to be bringing frozen chocolate covered bananas in honor of one dear Christian F. Bigfoot Bjornsson.
Yep.
And then we're gonna celebrate Inherent Vice with and we're gonna watch the movie as God and PTA intended, which is in a dark room in Los Angeles on 35 fucking millimeter film.
Oof.
Hearts full of heartbreak and hope and a little high. And we're gonna watch a film that I think is the masterpiece of 2014. I think it's PTA's masterpiece, and I'm not gonna tell you why, because we spent 150 fucking hours already doing that. But I would invite anyone who wants to come on out, and you know, you're gonna see some familiar faces, you're gonna hear some familiar voices. I think a lot of LA-based Increment Vice guests are gonna be there. And afterwards, hey, you know, who knows? I think we're gonna go hit a bar next door, come see the movie, have a drink with us. I'll get Blake on FaceTime, and the phone can sit at the bar and he can watch us jibber jabber or something like that.
That would be wonderful. I would be happy to do that. I'll day drink in Australia while you guys are all having an excellent post Vice watch. I might have to watch it in my office so that I can be up to speed. This is excellent. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm so appreciative of your time. I can't wait for everything that you're doing with your great De Palma book. And we'll obviously be talking more about that in the lead up. But thank you so much for doing this. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me, buddy. I'll see you soon. And it feels like such a 20th century movie. It feels like something David Lean would have done or tried to do when he still had that kind of currency. And even then, he might not have succeeded.
It's incredible because, like, if you don't have time to watch all five seasons of Lost, you can just watch Fearless.
Not a week goes by that I don't think of the ending of Gallipoli. It's left a mark. A Year of Living Dangerously. You know, and then something like Last Wave, even, that's so deeply embedded with the land and the story of the land, the story of place. You know, I don't know that I'd seen very many movies at that point in my life that had such a down ending, and they had such a, you know, sort of strong sense of folklore attached to it as that. And something always so poetic and lyrical about Peter Weir's work.
Gallipoli was the first movie that ever traumatized me, and I don't think I ever really recovered from it. And I'm still upset that they played it in school. Like, I don't think it's actually possible to make an... They say it's not possible to make an anti-war movie, but I think Peter Weir pulled it off.
Yes.
Because no one watches that movie then thinks, I want to go to war.
Peter Weir is the greatest director that Australia has ever produced. Like, bar none, hands down. Like, no one else has even in the room.
I think you have covered some really titanic filmmakers and some really titanic films so far, but I truly think what makes Peter Weir special and what makes you doing this one special is we don't talk about Peter Weir that way, and we should. Peter Weir is one of those guys who I don't get why he isn't a bigger name, why he isn't more in that rarefied air,
yes.
Because I think film for film, he's one of our very best filmmakers. He has brought his A game repeatedly to many properties. There are films of his that I hold very dear. Fearless, The Mosquito Coast. I will fight somebody if they talk bad about The Mosquito Coast. It's, man, I love that movie. But in general, I just think he is a special filmmaker, a smart, lyrical, hallucinatory filmmaker. He's a very dreamy filmmaker, and I don't think he gets his due.
You know, Master and Commander is one of my all-time favorite movies. Easily one of the best movies of the last 20 years. It's, you know, there's a grand scale. There's a historical backdrop to it. But at the same time, there is such an intimacy in the relationships.
Which I think is not just a great film and one of the last great epics in the truest sense. I think is actually kind of a sliding doors change point moment in cinema history. I think 2003, when that comes along and it is an old fashioned, you know, we don't make them like that anymore type film. I think if Master and Commander spawns a franchise at that point, the entire cinema landscape globally is completely different.
That's the movie that I wanted to see 10 of those, you know. And yeah, I know they're big fans of Fast and Furious and everything, and God bless you, but Master and Commander should have been.
It's one of those things, again, I'm not a seafaring man, sir. But there is a sense of authenticity. There's a sense of really watching a genuine dedication to recreating history unfold on a big screen in front of you that can't help but inspire just genuine admiration and awe.
If you're going to pick a film where he really brings every one of his skills to the table, it's Master and Commander. I think you picked the right one, man.
Yeah, very excited to see what you pull out of this, Blake.
That's right. Our next series is Peter Weir and Russell Crowe's Master and Commander. The series is called Podcaster and Commander.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.